Welcome back to another episode of the Open Source Cafe. I'm very excited for this one because I'm talking to Pravath. And Pravath has built something awesome called OpenObserve. And we're going to talk about the observability space. We're going to talk about founder journeys. By the way, congrats on the funding, Pravath, to you and the entire OpenObserve team. This episode will be really cool because they are sort of like disrupting the observability space, and the project is absolutely incredible. But we're going to talk much more about that. We're going to talk about the team's journey, Pravath's journey, some of the best practices that you can follow. But before we dive into all of those, Pravath, do you want to give yourself a quick intro? What are you doing these days, and where were you before?
Thank you, Kunal. Thanks for having me. So I'm Pravath. I'm the founder of OpenObserve, based out of San Francisco Bay Area, California. Started OpenObserve in 2022. I was based out of San Francisco Bay Area itself for around 4.5 years. Before that, working for AWS as a solutions architect. And for the last 2 years at AWS, I was a specialist architect for containers and Kubernetes, helping a lot of customers of AWS. So I worked with startups like 2 people to 10 people companies, mid-tier companies like 100 to 5,000 people companies, and some of the largest customers of AWS as well, including companies like Disney, Comcast, Asana, Confluent, and more. And one problem that kept coming up was observability, specifically logs at that point in time. And the obvious solutions were Splunk, Datadog, and Elasticsearch. And while Splunk and Datadog were good solutions, a lot of people gravitated towards Elasticsearch. Primarily because of the cost reasons. And pretty much everybody that I knew used Elasticsearch in one or the other capacity for observability. And I recommended Elasticsearch to my customers at that point in time that, hey, use this, this is a good tool. And eventually, within 3 months, those customers will come to me that, hey, Pravath, it worked well in the beginning, and it doesn't work now. Too much of babysitting, and scaling problems, performance issues. And I was like, okay. And then I started seeing the pattern that pretty much everybody uses Elasticsearch and everybody hates it. And I started thinking, how do we end up in a situation in the world where everybody uses something, this particular stuff, and everybody hates it? And I was like, this was in 2021. And I was like, I'm not the first, I could not be the first guy to notice it. Elasticsearch was released in 2010. And since then, there are a lot of technologists out there. Many, many extremely smart people. Somebody would have done something. Let me just find it. And then I searched around a lot of open source and commercial solutions. I found that in the open source world specifically, there were a lot of good products, not good products, actually good technologies. And then what I also learned was a good technology does not necessarily mean a good product. I was like, okay, what do I do? And then I thought, let me make something. And I was not looking to start a company, just to solve a problem. Then over the weekends and the evenings, just as a hobby, trying to solve a problem, I built an open source project, released it on GitHub, and posted it on Reddit. In week one in 2021, it got more than 3,000 stars on GitHub. So it became very popular. A lot of people started downloading it and using it. And that was the genesis. And then the realization hit that, hey, there's a real need out over there. A lot of people are using it, and we can build a company around this. And that is when, after a couple of months, I left AWS, and 4 years later, here we are.
That's amazing. So you saw firsthand massive enterprises scaling cloud native environments, and you're like everyone using Elasticsearch, but the cost and log storage complexity is just not working out. Because you worked with a lot of customers for AWS, was there a pivot in terms of like a single specific customer crisis or like a breaking point during your AWS years that made you realize that, okay, the industry's default dependency on inverted like index databases is broken, and now I'm going to build you like a replacement?
Yeah, it was not a single event, but a combination of a lot of conversations that I had with customers and what I started seeing in their environment. And inverted indexes themselves are not too bad, but if they are done badly, it is a problem, because inverted indexes, the way Elasticsearch and Splunk do it, inverted index, you do not get them for free. There is a cost of computation. There's a cost of storing those indexes. Those are very, very high. And that needed to be solved. And specifically, there was a challenge around data volume. Since 2015, kind of, if you start going from there on, the data volume started growing rapidly. And Elasticsearch and Splunk, they were not able to handle these volumes very well. Splunk handled it much, much better, but it required a lot of hardware. And Elasticsearch did not really handle it very, very well. So while inverted index themselves are not bad, they do solve a problem of finding things much, much faster through the indexing, but it has to be done right.
Interesting. And let me pick up your brains on, so you left AWS, and I did some research, correct me if I'm wrong. The platform's journey started in around 22 as Zinc Search. Is that correct?
You are right.
And it was written in Golang, and you were promoting it like, okay, this is a lightweight alternative to Elasticsearch. Now, I can be wrong. That's just something, it's very easy to research nowadays.
Yeah.
And you raised 3.6 million seed round, and you had close to 8,000 GitHub stars. And then shortly after that, the team is like, we're gonna rewrite the entire data plane into Rust, and now we're gonna launch OpenObserve, right? So you, as a VC-backed founder, you are rewriting your whole product from scratch in a different language. Obviously, massive risk, but you all are smart people. You know what you're doing. Clearly, it's working. Fast forward to today. But my question is, what technical limitations did you hit with Go's runtime, the language in general? How do you justify moving to, a different language like Rust to your board as well? So this is like a question for, it's just a really interesting learnings that we can get from you. Why did you move from Go to Rust?
Yeah, no, you're right. I never thought that I would do it, but I did it. So when I left AWS, before I left AWS, I actually, I was reached out by a lot of VCs, more than 24 VCs looking at the Zinc Search, which was written in Go. And it was a single binary. It was like around 50 MB, a binary that you could download it. It'll run in under 100 MB of RAM on your laptop in under a minute. You're up and running and worked well. We still had to build a distributed version of it, because at large scale, for enterprises, you need a distributed system that can handle large volumes. And when we started testing the first version, which I built as a hobby tool, that was like, okay, it is a tool that works. But then when we started pressure testing it, we realized that it had performance challenges, specifically due to the memory management. Go essentially uses garbage collection, which essentially means that Go as a programming language, it manages the entire memory for you. When you're allocating variables, deallocating them, you don't really do that. Okay. The runtime does that for you. And many a time, if you look at an observability system, at the end of the day, it is a database. If you look at it from a most simplistic point of view, you need to be able to write data very, very fast. And then you need to be able to read data from it extremely, extremely fast. And what we know, and you need to be able to do it extremely efficiently. What we found was that while we could write and read fast, memory was not in our control. Memory would spike up pretty high at times, and we couldn't really decide it. And that led to out-of-memory errors and multiple challenges around this. And we were like, we need to contain this. And the amount of time and effort that we had to fight with, go runtime to do this, was like not worth it. And then we were like, what do we do? Then we said, let's try Rust. And when we moved to Rust, we actually wrote the same algorithm for searching data. And we wrote an example program in Go as well as in Rust. And the Rust version ran more than 2 times faster. We were like, we are going here. We don't have to manage memory. It is faster. That was the take. And then we also found a project called Apache Arrow Data Fusion, which provided us with a lot of primitives for accessing data. It provided us a SQL query layer as well on top of it. So we didn't really have to reinvent a query language. We could use SQL that pretty much everybody understands. So that was the journey of picking up Go versus Rust. And yes, it was more than technology. We were a VC-backed company. 3 months in after leaving AWS, raising money, I go back to my investors and tell them that, hey, thank you for showing your faith in me, giving me $3.6 million to build something. And Zinc Search has like 8,000 stars on GitHub, but we have hit a limit. We have hit a wall. This is not going to scale. We will have to rebuild it. And these were smart people. And they told me, Prabhat, do you realize what you're talking about? Do you realize how hard it is to get 8,000 stars on GitHub so fast? And this was, I mean, compared to today, where many of these AI products get there very, very fast, this was 2022. It wasn't really happening at that point in time. So 8,000 stars on GitHub at that point in time was quite a lot. They're like,
I mean, it's still... Still is a lot. 8,000 is it's still a lot of GitHub stars. Even in today's time, I would tell you. Yeah, I know. I have some friends who, shout out to Rohit Kumare. This guy keeps building projects and he keeps hogging GitHub stars like 10,000-ish. But no, I think it's still very solid. But where is OpenObserve right now?
So OpenObserve is like more than 18,500 GitHub stars, something like 19,000, reaching there. And so that is where we are. In terms of, while stars is one thing, we have over 7,000 plus active deployments globally. So startups, mid-tier enterprises, very large companies, people running as a hobby project in their home lab, everybody is running it. In fact, a very stark difference in the when it comes to the users that I see is that there are a lot of people we're running OpenObserve on Raspberry Pis because it is so efficient. There are also companies who are running OpenObserve on a 500 node cluster, ingesting petabytes of data every day. So we see both the ends.
Yeah. That's the beauty of open source. You know. Speaking of which, like I saw you recently gave a talk at KubeCon in San Francisco, and you were talking about hitting the absolute ceiling of very, very major cloud provider capabilities. So this is specifically like you mentioned hard limits and some quota restrictions that even if you spend a lot of budget, you cannot fix that. So the idea is that, it forces you to build your own custom supercluster. And that's what the story of OpenObserve is, right? So when we are processing this petabytes of telemetry data daily, and you're the best person to answer this on behalf of the project. What are the exact physical limits of like public cloud providers that money cannot solve? And what does running your own supercluster look like compared to like a standard cloud infrastructure?
Yeah, you're right. This was a very interesting one. So yeah, I gave this talk at KubeCon in San Francisco, which again, KubeCon, it sounds very similar to KubeCon. But this was a challenge that we faced at a major customer of ours who were running in GCP, ingesting over a petabyte of data every day. And when they started querying that particular data, that we store data in the object store. So in this particular case, it was GCS, Google Cloud Storage. And when they started querying data from GCS, queries would succeed. Things would work well. But after that, they would start getting errors, like error 429, too many requests. And what we found was that you cannot query more than around like 500 to 600 terabytes of data per day from a single bucket in GCS. You could get that increased with the help from by raising a request to GCP to up to 1 petabyte per day of read from a single bucket, but no more than that. And we were like, okay, what do we do? Customer is ingesting a lot more data than this. We have to query that. And we can't tell the customer that, hey, now yeah, you cannot query it. So what we did was a couple of things. Number one is that we added support for multiple buckets across multiple projects in GCP. So they have their own limits. And this was a hard limit, apparently, that we were told. That was one. Number two, now, because if you have multiple buckets and multiple projects, because they have their own limits, we could read more. Number two is what we did is that we built a concept of something called a super cluster. So you have two OpenObserve clusters running in parallel, okay, in two different regions, okay, in GCP. Or you can have one running in Azure, one in GCP, but that doesn't really matter. It can still work. And they're both connected to each other. Both of them can be ingesting data from each of these regions. They can have their own sources. And then you as a user can log on to the UI of any one of them and then query the data from both of them simultaneously to get a single view of the data. So multiple of these things that we did helped us alleviate that particular problem of not being able to query large amounts of data from a bucket. And this was essentially 1 petabyte per day. We learned it is not documented anywhere. We just found it by experiencing it.
Cool. Speaking of experience, by the way, I did a very long video on OpenObserve. It's full of demo only. So check it out. I'll leave it somewhere in the description. Or you can find it on my channel. But while I was doing that demo and while I was researching through the platform, the very first thing I noticed is the storage cost. So you achieve up to like 140-ish times lower cost storage. And when I was like, okay, this is interesting. What is the catch? So I was doing some research and I'm like, you're saving compressed Parquet files directly to S3 compatible object storage. And you don't store it on like local disks like many folks are used to. But if you use S3, this is my question, like when you use S3, it has some latency compared to local NVMe drives, obviously. And I was reading about your download manager. And that download manager, it's like a dual queue structure. So you use a priority queue for any recent data that you have. Within like it's a 1 hour window or 2 hour window, some hour window, and you have another normal queue for some older historical files, which makes sense. Like if you're not accessing that regularly, then fine, I don't need it. So my question is, how do you prevent the query response time from lagging when a user runs an ad hoc search across terabytes of multi-month historical data? Because the product is quite efficient. It's obviously cost is a, I like to think of it like the cost is a by factor of how highly performant the OpenObserve platform is. So cost is not the narrative here. You know, it's just an outcome of the efficiency and the compression and the tech that you have behind. But if you can answer that question.
Yeah, totally. And you're very right. Cost is a byproduct of the architecture that we have built. So the first thing is I'll go briefly over how OpenObserve cost efficiency is like 140 times. And when I had to many a times repeat and say that, hey, it is 140 times, not 140%. Yeah. So the way essentially it works is that we, whenever you ingest log data or any other kind of telemetry data, we take that, convert that into Parquet files, and Parquet files generally have very extremely high compression. So the first place where we save a lot of storage cost is by compressing data. Number two is we go ahead and store it in the object store, which is like three times cheaper than your standard EBS volumes. And then, and in comparison to tools like Elasticsearch, Splunk, and other tools of older era, look at us, we are engineers, we are technical people. And as technical people, there is only one way that we know of on how to avoid data loss in case of a hardware failure. And that way is, hey, go ahead and make more copies of it. One hard disk can fail, two can fail, but the three, the probability is much lower. Okay, the more the number of disks, the replicas that you have, the lower the probability of failure is. So Elasticsearch and systems similar to that, they make multiple copies of that data, roughly around three copies at least. So the cost multiplies by three. In the case of OpenObserve, because we store data in the object store, and your cloud provider like AWS, GCP, Azure, they already replicate the data in the backend. So you don't really have to do that. So that is also a cost advantage. Now, you've gotten the 140x lower storage cost. Let's talk about performance. How does that work? First is that the latency from S3 on object store is real. It's an object store. You have to make an HTTP call. And when you have hundreds of files in or thousands of files in object store, pulling data does take time. So what we do is that, like the one that you talked about, a download manager, what we do is that we cache the recent data on the courier disks. And we prefer them to be NVMe disks, primarily because OpenObserve is I/O bound. OpenObserve is so efficient on compute that compute is generally not the problem. We always, the bottleneck is always I/O. So we try to cache as much of data on NVMe disks as possible and run queries against that. And this is done very, very intelligently through the download manager. So we query, because if you look at the observability data, the first 24 hours of data is like kind of queried most of the times. Beyond that, generally you do not query, but you do query sometimes. Let's talk about the first 24 hours of data, because that is generally you can store it on a local NVMe disk and you're not replicating them. So the cost is much lower. And because you're not storing all the data and you're storing it in compressed format, the cost is much, much lower as well. Let's talk about multi-month data. We have multiple kinds of caches. One is, caches is one, but even before the caches. So there are two kinds of queries generally that you run. One is a search query. For example, you're doing a log search. So you're searching for a term called error or exception. So what you are looking for is maybe 100, 200 records or events. So the second kind of queries are analytical queries, where, for example, if you have your web server logs, how many of them were 200 okay? How many of them were 500 errors? How many of them were 300 redirect? Okay. So these are pure analytics queries. For the search queries, you can go via index and still go and fetch things much, much faster from Object Store, because you do not really need a whole lot of data to pull from Object Store. It can be very, very pointed. But for the analytical queries, you really have to pull in all the data and then crunch all of those that data and give you a single dashboard. That is going to become a problem. So the way we have solved is the second part, analytical queries, is that. Now, the good and bad thing about analytical queries is that the bad thing is that you'll have to crunch all the data. The good thing is that you generally run these queries on a fairly regular basis. Okay. And which means that, say for example, you're running a dashboard every day, okay, at say 9 a.m. and you say that, hey, give me the last 1 month of dashboard of what was our 200 OK or 500 errors, that particular dashboard. So if you run it on the day one for last 30 days, we will crunch all the data, all the numbers. It may take some time if it is not in the local NVMe store. But it is one time. And you'd say you ran this on 1st of January. Come 2nd of January, when you're running the very same dashboard, you had past 29 days of data already there in the cache. You have to crunch only 1 day of data. So that is going to be extremely, extremely fast. Second, from 9 a.m. on 1st of January, from first ran it on 9 a.m. Then you run it, for example, at 10 a.m., your colleague runs it. Your colleague will get the fresh data, but your colleague has to crunch only 1 hour of data from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. So you are able to get a dashboard and analytical query running for 30 days by crunching only 1 hour of data. And OpenObserver is also generally much faster than other systems on crunching the numbers as well. So things become a whole lot faster. So these are many of the things that we have done. And there are multiple optimizations that we have done. But this is called semantic time chunking.
That's quite interesting, because it also answers my question. When I was doing my research for the video, I was reviewing like side-by-side benchmarks, you know, using the Astronomy Shop, which also I'll leave the links in the description. So what I saw that if you send some identical telemetry stream, it cost like 100 and, for example, $74 a day on Datadog. And compared to OpenObserver, that's like $3 a day. So that's a massive, massive difference, right? And you have also written about like legacy billing traps, specifically Datadog's high watermark, right, host system, and how you can have like custom metrics that can constitute over 50% of an enterprise invoice. So that's interesting. You know, there's a hidden billing trap in your legacy observability systems, where if you're emitting standard open telemetry spans and you are tying that in with some Gen AI metadata, that can automatically trigger some premium LLM monitoring tiers. And even though me as a user, I'm not opting in, but my bills are now increasing. And the project, OpenObserver treats LLM spans as standard traces under a flat volumetric rate. So that's interesting, because if you talk about like AI first workloads, how they scale, you know, my question to you is, how do you position your project to capture this massive influx of LLM telemetry that the legacy players are just pricing out of reach?
No, great question. Specifically from Datadog and compared and some others, high watermark and custom metrics and series of metrics. Okay, so if you have a different series which is defined as separate different combination of labels for a metric, they become very, very problematic in terms of pricing. Also, a lot of these companies, they charge you based on the number of hosts, number of containers, number of pods. And that brought a lot of uncertainty amongst technical leaders who are responsible for observability. And so we were looking at how do we make this more predictable, more simple to understand. Because somebody once told me, look at this Datadog bill. I don't even understand what this is. How many items are there in this? So they're like, okay, fine. How simple can we make it? So we said, okay, anything that you do, a simple volume is all you need. Okay. So it's still going to be variable, but a far simpler model. So the first, a couple of things. Number one, no high watermark, no custom metrics, no different series, and no per host, pod, or container-based pricing. That's on the pricing front. But let's talk more about the technology itself and the problem that we are trying to solve here. We built a full stack platform for logs, metrics, traces as well. And we have now added also agent observability, which is AI agents, as well as LLM application observability. And you're right, we process them as standard traces. And we have very specific UI specifically for LLM agents and traces because they are different in nature than the standard traces, standard application traces. They're similar but different as well and need to be treated and need a specific treatment. And what we learned was that people were trying to build, to have multiple systems now. One for your standard observability, one for your LLM observability, and people were not liking it. I mean, they were picking up these point solutions, but because there were no full stack solutions. Yeah.
So I want to talk about open source a bit. You originally released the project under the Apache 2.0 license, and then you moved it to AGPL 3.0 license. So why that shift? And also, you know, many enterprise legal teams are also quite allergic to copyleft licenses. So what was the primary catalyst of this migration? And did you see any friction for sales when, you know, an enterprise wants to self-host, but their legal department is like, okay, AGPL software, I don't know. But what has your experience been, and how would you guide others who are planning to implement or self-host OpenObserve?
And a very valid and important question. To tell you, let's talk about why we made the change. I don't recall. I think that was in 23, something like, or 22. I don't remember the exact date or time when we changed it from Apache to AGPL. But the primary reasons were, what we were seeing was that large organizations, and we're talking about multi-billion dollar organizations, they have a habit of picking up open source projects and benefit from them and never contribute back to the community. So licenses like Apache 2.0 and MIT, they do not force anybody to do anything. You take the code, do what you wish. You do not have to contribute back. And these are the companies who have a lot of resources to contribute, but they keep benefiting, but never contribute back. And what happens is that it invokes a problem generally called a tragedy of commons. Everybody benefits from the product, but nobody contributes back. And we can't make money from these enterprises as well because they don't support us. You're like, okay, so what's the difference between Apache 2.0 and AGPL? From an end user point of view, there's literally zero difference. If you are a startup or enterprise, and if you want to use an AGPL licensed software, you're free to use it. There is no obligation on you. There's nothing that you have to contribute back if you're not modifying. But if you're modifying it and offering it as a service, you'll have to open source the changes that you have made as well. So that's the only clause. And the large organizations that say that we do not want AGPL software, we are banning it, simply because of that clause that if you make a modification to an open source software, you have to contribute it back as well. And if, think about it, morally, you're using an open source software yourself, you're benefiting from it, and then you're making modifications to it as well. Why not contribute it back to the community? And if you do not like contributing it back, then that in itself is not in good faith. And AGPL prevents that kind of situation. That is why AGPL. Okay, that was our philosophy. Have you faced any issues around because of this? Any friction because of this? The organizations that we work with, no, because they understand this. Okay. And the adoption has not slowed down because of change in license. We haven't seen anything.
Amazing. No, completely valid point around giving back. I think that makes sense. And that also keeps the project growing. And that's the open source spirit also. You, by the way, at the beginning I mentioned, congrats on Series A funding. You closed a 10 million round, which is awesome as of today, May 20th, 26, just in case someone is watching it after a few months when you have raised Series B or C. So I read that your investors preempted the round before you even formally went into the market. It's quite rare for a VC environment to do that. So was it like it makes sense. I mean, close to 20,000 GitHub stars, and at the beginning of this podcast, you mentioned around 7,000 active organizations are using it. So I believe that would have given them a very strong conviction to write that check before you even put together like a pitch deck. Or what do you think?
Indeed. And we had good adoption. We had good revenue coming in and from large enterprises and smaller enterprises as well. And we were not looking to raise money. We were capital sufficient. And one fine evening, this was an internal round from existing investors. So one fine evening, one of our investors gives me a call saying that, hey, Prabhat, can we meet tomorrow morning? This is a message. I was like, yeah, sure. And I was like, let's meet at 9 a.m. I'm like, okay, let's do it. And I asked him, okay, what is it about? And I did not really get a response back. But I was like, okay, fine. I mean, these investors are like friends at this point in time. They understand technology and open source very, very well, and the business as well. So next morning, they're like, hey, Prabhat, we would like to preempt your Series A for OpenObserve. I'm like, okay. They're like, we think that this is the right time. The project has got extremely good traction, and I think you could use the extra money to increase the adoption. So that was the thought. And you build more stuff that users are looking for. So that was the thought. That is how it happened. And I was like, I don't really have to prepare a pitch deck, go to people and ask for money. I'll take it. I would rather focus on customers and users.
Yeah, and you have done that. I mean, you introduced bring your own bucket model. So now you can manage the query plane, but the data can be directly into the customer's S3 or any Azure containers or whatever. I think that is quite important because of like compliance, for example, for data residency for a lot of customers, especially if it's in a regulated industry. A lot of people have, including me, concerns about data egress concerns, right? Like I'm going to pay a hefty amount if I'm moving cloud providers. And it's just, I think, nice to give that sort of like choice to the customers. Cool. I want to ask you one more question, Prabhat, before we wrap it up. You said that, running a fragmented legacy observability stack is like operating a fire department that doesn't have a budget for smoke detectors. I read that somewhere. When you look at the future, there's also like a discussion around UI-less observability. So all these traditional dashboards that we are known for, it's going to become obsolete. So what is your vision for observability, you know, in the coming future, and all this AI bit with like autonomous remediation? How close do you think we are actually to a world where the software reliably repairs itself before like a human SRE is coming in at midnight or whatever? And as a founder, how do you build an engineering trust in an AI that can make these life changes to production infrastructure? So what does the future look like? How do you prepare for it? And that's my question to wrap it up. Because OpenObserve also has like an AI assistant. So you are not leaving that boat. You are doing stuff, cool stuff with AI as well.
Indeed. So the way we are thinking about it is that for the most part, let's think about it. Why do you want an observability tool? Yeah. You actually do not need an observability tool. You are not looking for a tool. You're looking for a solution. A solution for what? For two things. One, as long as you have systems, because they're going to break, you are looking to find the problems as soon as they happen. Okay, and you want to be able to solve them as fast as possible. The first one, as soon as you want to find about them as soon as they happen, is generally called mean time to detection. How fast can you detect? And how soon can you solve it is generally called mean time to resolution, MTTD and MTTR. These are the two technical terms that you that are to be thought of. And that is what we need. That is why people use observability tools. Of course, people also use it to understand, but understanding is like, okay, I know about every page in encyclopedia. What do I do with that? Yeah. So it's more about solving these two problems. And we think that while people have traditionally used dashboards and query interfaces manually, with the advent of AI, and how intelligent it has become, you can go ahead and let AI query your existing systems, observability tools, and let it figure out an answer whenever there is a problem that happens. And what we are calling it internally is headless observability. A lot of teams are heading towards this direction. And the way it essentially works is that you've got an MCP server of your observability tool. You've got also five other tools that you may or your observability tool may or may not have integrated with. But however, a general purpose agent like Claude Code or Hermes or OpenClaw, they can connect to multiple of these systems independent of you as a observability tool provider. And they can query all of these observability. When there is a problem that happens, they can query this observability tool. It can connect with other tools as well, correlate, and find where the problem is and provide an answer. Now, on the face of it, it looks good, but there are some challenges around this as well. Okay, the first thing is that how do you know when the problem happens? Okay. The general way of figuring out that particular problem is via alerts. And you're not going to be, how many alerts can you make on your own? So what we are doing is that we're providing a pre-built library of alerts. What we also done is a pre-built library of anomaly detection based alerts. So they'll help you generate alerts whenever something wrong happens. And then a system takes over. And it can provide you automated analysis in the form of an SRE agent, what is known in the industry. But when a human comes, someone like an engineer like me or you, we can essentially fire up our general purpose agent like Claude Code or Hermes, and go ahead and say that, hey, this alert fired, and I have this particular recommendation from the observability tools SRE agent, but I want to know more. And I want to connect these three additional systems as well, probably where some additional information is there to which this my observability tool is not connected to. And then it can take a couple of minutes and give you an answer. And that is where we see things will go eventually. Not 100%. There will always be people using the traditional dashboards, query interfaces, but a lot of people will move to. And we are talking to a lot of users and customers who want to go in this direction.